Hi, and welcome back to Activists of Tech, the Responsible Tech Podcast. If cartography, the ancestor of GIS, already displayed colonial patterns and racist stereotypes back in the day, why would the digital legacy of maps be any different? Maps have an authoritative value and hold power through the representation of the world from the perspective of who draws them. However, communities are often excluded from their design, leading to the misrepresentation or omission of important landmarks and third places. In this episode, Kathy Richards explains why it is necessary for communities to have the tools to paint their own stories through mapping, what is the role of communities in the development of tech-powered solutions that include GIS, and what are the risks associated with the exclusion of said communities. Kathy is a Civic Science Fellow and Data Inclusion Specialist at the Open Environmental Data Project. Previously, she was the Associate for Digital Resilience and Emerging Technology at the Engine Room, where she advised civil society organizations on their use of technology and data. As a Green Web Fellow, she investigated the benefits, ethical questions, and security risks associated with using GIS for environmental justice. Kathy holds a bachelor's degree in international relations from Boston University, an MPA from the Monterrey Institute of International Studies, and she comes from beautiful Costa Rica. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Excited.
I'm excited too. So what's your story?
Well, let's see. So I was born in Costa Rica, and that's important. I'll share why a little bit later. But yeah, I was born in Costa Rica, immigrated to the US like in the early 90s. But throughout definitely my early life, I had this, I want to say at least the way that it was presented at first was I had an obsession with space. But in reality, it was like an obsession with flying and seeing things from above, such that obviously in space you float, right? You don't necessarily fly, but you float. So I was very excited about that. But yeah, you know, from when I was little, I was like a super big fan of this man called Franklin Chang Diaz. He was the first Latin American immigrant, like NASA astronaut, selected to go into space, and he was Costa Rican. So naturally, I was like, this is who I want to follow. My mom actually, really cool, got me into a contest that allowed me to meet him. But you know what? Like, space is actually really scary. And as much as I love it, I don't know if I necessarily want to go up there. I think I do as a tourist, but not necessarily as a job. But yeah, I think from there, I just kind of always had this love for seeing things from above, looking at maps, history. I think the last two I got from my dad, who's a big time history buff and geography buff. And so from there, at first I started to go a little bit into engineering because I do love math and sciences. But eventually I switched over to studying international affairs, which kind of allowed me to mix everything together. And that's kind of how I developed all my passions and interests.
That's really cool. And I agree that space is very scary. I think a lot of kids were like, I'm gonna become an astronaut. And then you're like, oh, you can actually die. Watch out there.
Yeah. If anyone's ever, I think the moment where it hit me was when I watched Gravity. Was it Gravity?
Yeah.
And I was like, something is constantly trying to get her. So I think I'll stay here.
You know what? Maybe you can just be a tourist on Mars with Elon Musk.
Yeah. Probably with someone else. But yeah, I'll be a tourist.
All right. What is your professional background and how did you end up working in tech? Because just what you've explained, like you studied in, you know, hard science STEM and then international relation. Where did that lead you?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, like when I first went to college, I started out doing engineering work, but just very quickly realized that it just really wasn't necessarily for me. I actually, as introverted as I can be sometimes, I like hanging out with people, like spending time with people. So I switched over to international relations, as I mentioned before, in large part because, yeah, I do love history. I think if I could do, you know, outside of flying, if I could have any other special skill, it would be time traveling. And so I switched over to international relations, worked for a while strictly in international aid, just doing traditional programmatic work, but a little bit of dating myself. Around the time that data science started to become a thing, there was a moment in time when it was new. I just kind of really saw it as an opportunity to bring in a new skill into the sector. And so I started to teach myself to code and use it at work and just kind of, yeah, just really use it to automate things, make things a little bit easier so that we had time to do programmatic things. From there, I started to do more data-focused jobs, doing data analysis, data science work, et cetera. And then that essentially led me to where I am now, where it's like kind of not just doing the data work, et cetera, data management, things like that, but also doing tech assessments because it's really difficult to separate the data from the platform. You know, tech itself creates data. So yeah, I've been at the engine room for it's going to be about 5 years now, and have been kind of working in that space where it's we support civil society organizations and really all sorts of groups to work with tech and data responsibly. So just kind of once again, bigger picture, floating up in space, looking at the entire system of technology and data.
Before we deep dive into your work related to GIS, can you walk us through a short history of the ancestor of GIS cartography and how cartography relates to social justice?
Sure thing. And I'll probably take a step back because I think something I didn't mention was, now at my current position, I started to think more about, what other types of data we don't talk about as much, but we will be needing. And that's where I kind of started to dive a bit into GIS work and geospatial data and all things like that. But essentially, one of the big things for me at least was, as I was diving into it, as I shared, I do love history and I was starting to think, how did we get here? What is the human knowledge behind these platforms? Why do we have this button? Why is this even an option? And so I really started from the beginning, looking into cartography, the decisions that we made, what we learned along the way. One of the big things was, cartography or just generally creating maps is really about world making. Back in the day, at least, maps were often symbolic. They were more than just tools for navigation. They were just expressions of our understanding of the world. So they often displayed our perspectives of how things looked. The earliest known map, and I can share links to all of these, is Babylonia's Imago Mundi. And for the most part, it wasn't, if you were to try to use it to navigate now, and I think is the case with many ancient maps, you will obviously notice that it's not really for navigation. It might show you where your neighbor's house is located. It might show where there's a river, but it's not necessarily accurate, right? But then, as we all know, colonization started to change some things. And the need for maps that both gave direction and laid claim to land started to become necessary, right? It wasn't just this is here, Bob lives here, Melissa lives here. It was this is my land. This is how you navigate the land. This is how you get to these different types of land. And so this period saw the emergence of cartography, not just as a symbolic thing, but as a scientific discipline, with various techniques, et cetera. And that's when you kind of start to take into account projections and essentially just kind of how we perceive the world, how we depict a three-dimensional surface onto paper, which for listeners, it's really, how do you wrap that soccer ball, or sorry, that football that you purchase for a kid for the holidays. We all know that it's really difficult to wrap circular things. So, over time we've developed different ways of mapping these things, or sorry, wrapping these things. And with it came biases and just kind of all these different ways of perceiving the world just also kind of translated to this kind of more scientific paper route.
Yeah, that's super interesting actually, just to know that even in cartography, there were biases in maps. So, of course, digitalizing them, like a lot of things could have gone wrong and it did, right?
Exactly. And I'd probably add to that, and this we'll probably get into this a little bit later. I mean, the map makers, the explorers, colonizers.
Colonizers.
Yeah. So let's be honest. They were often the ones with access to mass production mechanism. So, they saw the Americas in a certain way and they drew it in that way and they said it was theirs. And then they went and printed thousands of copies of it. And it just made it a lot easier for them to kind of, yeah, multiply or share their biases and perspectives.
That's insane because what you just said, you could say it with so many other things nowadays. It's like nothing has changed, almost.
It's like nothing has changed. Access to these tools, yeah, access to these tools kind of changes how things can go, which is why it's, yeah, which is why it's so important to make sure that communities have access to these tools, can paint their own pictures, can share their own perspectives. But yeah, for the most part, nothing has changed. Someone will always have access to it first.
Yep, but this podcast is about hope. So let's move towards your fellowship. This year, you were a Green Web Fellow. Can you tell us about your project that investigates the utility, ethics, and security risks of GIS data? And actually, before we start, so that everyone is up to speed, what is GIS?
Yeah, for sure. So GIS is really one part of a larger ecosystem of technologies. And I think that was kind of one of my learnings as well throughout the fellowship was just the terminologies used. Sometimes we use GIS, or you'll find GIS being talked about in a certain way. But really what I'll start with is kind of like the bigger umbrella that would most people would call geospatial technologies. And that includes GIS, or geospatial information systems, which are just the platforms or the technologies that are used to create, manage, and analyze and map, really create the visualization of all types of data. So it's just kind of imagine Tableau, but for maps. And then you have, as part of geospatial technologies, you also have remote sensing technologies, which could include satellites, for example. You know, how often we use satellites to see how hot our oceans are. Or even other things that that can be used, like for example, sensors and things like that. And then the last one is essentially our satellite and location systems, our GPS systems. And that kind of all these technologies together help us map out our world. But I chose specifically to focus on the platforms because it's where most of these things come together. You're analyzing, you know, you're putting the remote sensing data into these platforms. You're creating maps, you're mapping whatever data points you might have, and you're using coordinates. So, definitely chose to start from there. I'd like to eventually cover all of them, but decided to start with the platforms.
You just said earlier that it was important for communities to have the tools to paint their own stories rather than rely on colonizers, for instance. What is the role of communities in the development of tech-powered solutions that include GIS? And what are the risks that are associated with the exclusion of these communities in the design and development of tech solutions?
Yeah, so I think one of the big things in terms of role of communities, it's defining priorities and needs. Like, what do we need from these platforms? Who are the current platforms built for? For example, is making sure that data is anonymized important to communities. I think in this sector, quite often, that's super important. We want to make sure that, you know, people that share the data can remain private and things like that. If so, how hard is it to do that? I think one of the findings in my through my project was that some tools, one tool in particular, let's say it's called QGIS. They have it's open source, so people can create solutions for this, plugins, etc. And one of the well, two tools actually that were or two plugins that were created were specifically to privatize and anonymize data. So it's fantastic in the sense where, you know, there was a need, the community met that need. Because quite often you don't want to necessarily, you know, tell the world, you know, activists live here or these are where the resources are. So that's really important. The other bit too that I found is around like data collection and validation. And anyone that has ever filled out a form has had that moment where your answer doesn't quite fit in the field provided. I know I faced this recently because in Costa Rica, we don't actually have addresses. We'll have something like 300 meters south of the police station and things like that. And so quite often I'll have a form that will ask for the usual street name, building number, et cetera, and zip code. And quite often I don't have those. So I have to just fill it in with whatever I need. And that often happens in many situations with these tools. It's they're built to kind of cover the needs of quite often the US. And so, you know, when other communities want to use it, it's really, really difficult for them. And that kind of brings me back to just kind of what I uncovered, or the reason for even going down this route, was that I had spent quite a bit of time with speaking with conservation practitioners and things like that. And they share that there have been instances where communities would map their own data, and someone else, usually a private sector company, would come in and use that data for alternative purposes. So I think some of the big needs are just kind of around defining priorities. You know, what do we need for these platforms? What are the current platforms built for example, you know, is making sure that the data is anonymized important? I think quite often in the private sector, it's less of a thing that's discussed. You know, one of the sectors that uses this quite often are the oil companies. They're constantly mapping things out. Logistics companies, things like that. So privacy is not as important as when you're mapping communities, mapping local activists. I think this also brings me kind of to how this project came about. But I was speaking with a lot of conservation practitioners who shared that quite often a community would map their assets, their natural resources. I won't say quite often, but at least in one case, the data was then purchased or found or taken by you know, realty, let's say resort company. And they then used that data to decide where the different parts of the resort were going to go. So hot springs, fantastic. Let's build a spa near the hot springs type of thing. And so that also kind of fits in with animals as well. There's been cases of, you know, there's tools or I guess like they're not necessarily social networks, but there's fun tools that people use to track wildlife. And some of the things that they've had to do is actually privatize some of the more the animals that are in danger of extinction, because then poachers were using the data from these platforms to find these animals and take them and, you know, do the things that
Oh.
sell them. Yeah.
Oh, lovely people.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. So it's, you know, having data is fantastic when it's in the right hands. And so, you know, things like that, that sometimes like these platforms are just like any other tech tool. They're just tech tools. Depends on how you use them. They can be used for malice. So really just kind of really understanding the needs of these communities, which are very different from private sector needs when you're using it for environmental justice. Then, you know, one of the things I shared too is just around data collection. Costa Rica doesn't have addresses. And so whenever I have to fill out a form, I actually filled one out last week. I was just, yeah, hitting my head against the wall because I couldn't figure out how to fill it out. But Costa Rica doesn't have addresses. So, for example, my parents' address is 300 meters from the police station. And quite often the forms are, you know, street address, building number, zip code, things that are very much like the US, because a lot of these platforms come from the US. And so, you know, I constantly have to make things up. I obviously always use zip code 0000 until I'm allowed to submit the form. But quite often these tools are just kind of very centered towards, I won't even say Western nations. Really, the US, pretty much, you know, quite often when you would open these tools, the defaults are US models of the world. So, you know, for example, let's say someone is in Brazil, they just open up the platform, they might not fully know about the different models of the world that are available, and they won't think to change it and end up with like a river that's possibly a couple meters off or things like that, like the elevations not being fully right. So, yeah, I would largely wrap it up around, you know, making sure that we're meeting the needs of these communities and the different contexts that we're going to work in. And to prevent the biases, I would probably say that we just have to think about open data standards, for example, using open, transparent standards for data management and ensuring that there's public access to GIS data sets to democratize the process in general. Also, inclusive data collection, ensuring that the data being put into GIS systems is collected from diverse sources. I think in other situations, and also going back to the forms, we've heard the stories where if people have last names that have two letters, the forms will throw back an error, right? And so we really need diversity in the groups that are creating these tools and the types of, you know, sample data sets that these creators see, because it really is going to be important for these tools to be usable for all communities. I think the other one is around regular audits and cross-verification. You know, constantly checking to see if these tools are meeting the needs, verifying with other data sources, especially from communities and other groups. I think quite often with many tools, once you start to get a little too big, you're just kind of, this is what we know, and this is what we're going to provide at all times. But it's just as simple as like reaching out to a local community and saying, is this really the name that you've given to your town? This is what we have, but it might not even be what you call it. And I think the other big one is around human-centered designs of these tools. Designing tools with, I think one of the things that I go into in my fellowship is just really the spectrum of tools available. For example, there's the tools that do a lot and they will help you do all the analysis. And they very likely use US defaults. And those are great, but then there's so many buttons and it requires a special type of computer with a certain amount of memory. And just really being able to dig into all the menu options. Whereas, one of the things that's happening now too is creating more accessible ways to make maps. But of course, you're stripping away like a lot of the capacities to do analysis, a lot of, up capacities to normalize data, which is essentially kind of making sure that you're referring to the same level of information. So for example, if you have environmental data at the country level, but data on social factors at a smaller town level, are you making the right conclusions about the community and things like that? So there are certain tools that, because they've been simplified, they might not have those options. They're significantly easier to use, but also kind of being able to teach people how to change all the settings so it really fits their context.
Yeah, it sounds like it's complicated. It's nuanced. If we want to include everyone, it's nuanced, but I think it's necessary work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, especially now, and I can also go a little bit into, yes, part of the reason for the fellowship was having these conversations, but also I felt like as we get deep, I mean, we're already in it, but as we get deeper and deeper into the climate situation, the planetary situation, we are going to have a need to map our world a bit more. And there's no one better placed to map the world than those people living in the community. And so, that was really one of the big reasons behind the desire to make this guide, to dive into this for the fellowship, was just, how can we do it? Is there a way to turn this thing that can sometimes be really complicated and convoluted into something that communities can really take hold of and maybe not necessarily make the maps themselves, but at the very least be able to question findings that are given to them. Let's say some big name organization, international organization, tells a small community in the global south, this is what we see your world as. At least have some knowledge to be able to push back and say, no, this is actually not right. And this is potentially the reason you might be grabbing data from here, et cetera.
I'm personally fascinated by the potential of participatory mapping to empower grassroots movements. Can you talk about how grassroots mapping has positively impacted marginalized communities?
Of course. Yeah. I think one of the big things is just the concept of empowerment and ownership. A lot of grassroots mapping initiatives, they give marginalized communities a chance to tell their own stories, to create their own maps, collect their own data, and just kind of share going back to this world making concept, to make their own worlds. I think, one of the things that happens often in conversations that I've had with others is just just as simple as defining what local is. Just to give an example, myself living in New York, sometimes Google Maps will say that something is local to me, but then it will ask me to get on two different subway lines. And that's not local. If I have to change transportation mechanisms, that's just no longer local to me. Local, at least for me, is maybe one train line or just like being able to walk a couple of blocks. And it really varies by each person, by each community. So really, these participatory mapping, it really lets us create the world and the ways that we see it, which, I'm sure, I mean, a lot of the people that live near me would say the same. It's like, it's on the other side of the park. That's no longer local to us. So things like that. I think the other one is just the visibility of environmental injustices. Many marginalized communities face environmental issues such as industrial pollution or, as I mentioned before, resource exploitation that often goes unnoticed by official agencies. One thing that I've learned about in the last few months was just how communities are monitoring their own air quality, specifically in areas where there are last mile delivery hubs. And essentially they are kind of mini warehouses that companies such as Amazon, use to be able to get us our products that much faster. So just kind of imagining little spokes or little smaller hubs in communities. And most of the time, they put these last mile delivery hubs in just low income communities where there's a lot of people of color, because that's usually where they put these things. And so what some of the people in these communities have been doing, they've been able to kind of use their own air quality sensors and just kind of their own monitoring mechanisms to be able to report what's going on at their level. So, to say like a lot of the school children have asthma, or people are not sleeping enough because you're hearing these trucks going in and out of communities at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. So it really gives people a chance to kind of, really make visible what's really happening in their world. And then the other one, just also building networks, I think can foster collaboration between communities. For example, if the community that's doing air quality monitoring on their own, they share their findings, or they just simply talk about what they're doing. Other communities that also have their own hubs can also kind of connect with them, share knowledge, things like that. So it really kind of serves as a way to just really own your world and be able to tell the world your story.
It's very true, actually. When you mentioned Google Maps, it made me think about, and I learned that recently, that small shops and coffee shops have to pay to be put at the as recommendations on Google Maps. And I don't think it's a fair representation of our communities, actually, if people have to pay to just appear on the map.
100%. It's great that you said that, because even recently I was walking around town with my dad, and we were trying to find a small print shop that was just nowhere to be found on the map. And I can't remember the statistic right now, but a lot of our world is actually not mapped on Google Maps. The small shops, this little small places that everyone in the community knows and people in the community gather at, nowhere to be found on these big tech maps. So yeah, it's really important that, let's say, let it be those Google Maps or even our own maps that we make, that we really make an effort to map the bike lanes too, to say like these are the streets where you can safely ride your bike. So yeah, really important for people to contribute to their mapping, and do so safely. There's lots of initiatives doing that, so it's great.
But so speaking of, what are the data governance frameworks in place for geographic information systems?
Yeah, I will say that at least from the research, I won't say that I was able to find one specifically, but there's been a lot of different efforts to kind of have more structure around these things. I will say again, kind of like I mentioned, going back to the original discipline, the British Cartographic Society, they kind of have their own kind of s a framework for how members should be doing their map making, their cartography. And those are around honesty, like leading with honesty, integrity, competence, respect, and responsibility. So a little bit more around the lines of, how should we approach this? There's also other groups, like different groups got together, and they created the map makers mantra. And it covers things like being honest and accurate, transparent and accountable, minimizing harm, which is something that we know very, very well in the digital rights space, and seeking to provide value. So not just making maps for the sake of making maps, and being humble and courageous. But then from that, I think, there's quite a few organizations, and even I will say platform providers, for example, Esri and people from QGIS and other platforms that have started to kind of become together, create their own consortiums. I think the group is called Ethical Geo. They came up with their own kind of guiding principles, very similar, and kind of they continue to build on each other, but it covers things like, realizing opportunities, understanding impacts, protecting the vulnerable, minimizing data, which is a thing that we talk about quite often. Sometimes we just collect more data than we need, so it's really important to just collect what we need. And protecting privacy, it definitely covers quite a bit more that you can see in the guide. But as you can see, they're continuing to build on each other. But also, fantastically, because we're using so much geographic and location data, there have been efforts to kind of include that in actual policies. So of course the GDPR has its section on location data. But for example, the US government has created a national spatial data infrastructure, and with that, kind of some guidelines that go with it. And so those kind of give people some direction around how they should be using geospatial data. Aside from, minimize harm, things like that, there's more concrete steps that they can take to protect the data, to work with the data. Because I think people are realizing how important it is to keep it safe, to be responsible with it, because in the wrong hands, it could definitely create some problems.
Yeah, and that's the least we can say, create some problems. So maps are authoritative in a way. They hold power as well, as you've explained. How can we ensure that community mapping is as trusted as institutional mapping, as it's perceived as good?
Yeah, for sure. I think, community mapping projects need to, I think, to feel or for people to look at them the same way. They need to ensure the same levels of data accuracy, validation, and verification as institutional maps. This can be achieved, of course, through training, community, like training community members and best practices for data collection and mapping. And ensuring the use of like standardized mapping practices, right? Like, we can get creative, but there's certain types of maps that you'll be able to use in court. And then there's maps that you'll put on your blog, of course. But I also think it's important to note that when I say, you need to make it valid and accurate, I don't want it to sound as if it's only accurate if it conforms to what international bodies say. Because again, this is about world making. This is about being able to, a community being able to describe what their world looks like. And so I don't definitely want it to seem as if, we have to use the term that, I don't know, Google Maps uses or the UN uses for this specific location. It can be accurate too and verified by the community. So it's mainly important that the community themselves can reproduce their findings, agrees on their findings. You wouldn't want half of the town saying that the river it belongs to the neighboring town and then the other half the town saying the opposite. So it's really important that it just really reflects what communities are saying. And that brings me to the next point, the importance of open access and documentation and reproducibility. Sharing your methods and your data to the extent that you can, it allows for greater scrutiny and transparency, and it also invites peer reviews from both experts, other towns, other community groups that can help validate the data. I've always said that, documentation is a love letter to your future self. That's actually from someone else whose name escapes me at the moment. But it's really, I think it's really important that we document this is where we found the data, this is how we collected it, this is how we mapped it, so that someone else can also come in and kind of see your process, your methods, be able to create it themselves, in an ideal world. And this is very from the data analytics world. And science world, I guess, really. It's really important that someone can come in, follow your steps, and come to the same conclusions, right? Which, a little segue is one of the issues with AI at the moment. You can ask it the same questions multiple times, and it might give you slightly different answers each time. So documentation is super, super important. And then there's narrative power. Community maps often come with a story, a narrative tied to lived experiences. And I think one of the big things about community mapping is versus what we often see on the news and things like that, is that people are sharing their stories, their lived experience, not just data, not just numbers, but they can, challenge institutional narratives behind what is being told, build trust. Because, one thing is when you're seeing a map or when you're seeing a news briefing on something that happens in your community, sometimes, we'll say that's not really my experience. But when you have a community member, your neighbor, be it, so it be, that's really when you're like, yeah, this has been my experience. I love this. I trust this person. And then very lastly, I will say, it gives you a chance to collaborate with others, as I mentioned before. It could be NGOs that are working on these initiatives, or technical experts that can lend further credibility to community-driven mapping projects.
Let's move to the lightning round. Are you ready?
I am.
What do you do to remain hopeful for the future of tech?
Honestly, I think it's, looking at the newest generations, in some ways. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Gen Z. I have a few of those in my family. And they were definitely one of the first ones to reject a lot of things. For example, it's like we're not going to put our pictures on Instagram. But they are very critical of all the right things. I feel like they are focused on creating a different world. In many ways, they're some of the among the most affected. And yeah, I just think it's fantastic, honestly. Like the newer generations have been saying all the right things about tech. Of course, we all use it. We use the ChatGPT. That doesn't mean that we're not going to, but they're definitely much more critical and they're asking the right questions. And I do think we're going to figure it out.
What is your favorite thing about responsible tech?
Oh, I'll go back to a similar thing. The people. I think it's a group of people that are constantly looking for solutions or how to get to the other side or how to work with things in this world. It isn't, I think, one of the things I shared was that they don't necessarily see technology as this huge solution that's, you press a button and everything is fixed. I think it's a group of people that sees it as a tool. And like many tools, it's, one of my favorite movie scenes. This is not one of the lightning round questions, but one of my favorite movie scenes is from Apollo 13 when they need to make a filter. And they gather a bunch of people in a room, and it's basically like, this is what the astronauts have. It's basically a box, and I think some piping or something. We need to make a filter from these items. And I think it just kind of seeing them as tools, seeing them as objects that can be used in different ways, I think it really makes us creative. And it's not simply, this tool is used for this, or this tool can be used for advertising or whatever it is. It's, let's use this tool to map animals, or let's use this tool to communicate internally. For example, mesh networks, where people are like, let's create this kind of local mesh network so, kids have access to books and things like that. So I think it's a fantastically creative community that really approach problems in a very specific way.
What's your song of the moment?
Oh, this is a tough one. There's been a couple that I've been playing nonstop, but I'll give you this one because I definitely heard it the other day and I absolutely fell in love. And it's called in Spanish, El Beso de la Ciguatera. And it's by Juan Luis Guerra. Happy to provide the link. And it's just so wonderfully joyful and Caribbean, and it makes me think of a tropical vacation.
Oh, that's the best. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mi historia social es cartelera, todo un personaje de novela, de amores sufrido lo imposible.